Hi, everybody. This is Alex Watts with the Endofunctor podcast. Today, I am joined with Jim Perillo, a.k.a. James Perillo, who is the managing partner of Figment Capital. Is that your title?
Sure. I'm a partner. Yeah. I mean, yes.
So just like as like an aside, I have like a bunch of questions, but just since I accidentally stumbled on it in the beginning, what the fuck do like the different titles mean for like all the VC teams? It's so, like MP and then just like partner and then the liquidity or the LPs are the limited partners who are just the people like investing. But like.
So, I mean, for us, like we're like three people. So to have titles and everybody has like carry and there's like two people on the investment team and there's our like COO, CFO as well. And so like to say like that I am, and I think what ultimately what you're getting at is that there's like a hierarchy, right? That there's like the managing partner is like up here and like the partners are here. And then, you know, the analysts or the principals are here. And then the, you know, it's like, what is the hierarchy here, right? Like really, we all work in the same office. We sit right next to each other. There's no glass doors, there's no glass walls. Like, I mean, I think one of the things that's really great about our team is that like, we're like a flat organization, right? Like how much can I really delegate to someone else and how much can someone delegate to me? Like we're three people, like we're just all doing as much as we can do to like, you know, make the firm successful. And so I think when you get into maybe more bigger, more established funds or companies, like anything, because like, a fund is a partnership, right? And so partnerships generally have partners and they have like employees. And like, this actually goes into like what I used to do as my prior job, but like law firms are partnerships, funds are partnerships, accounting firms are partnerships. And these are like professional services companies. All three of those are professional services companies, regardless of how professional or unprofessional you think crypto VC is. And so when you look at that, like partners are owners in the business, right? They're partners of the business. And then you have like, so sometimes you'll have like a senior partner and like generally they're like gray, they have gray hair. They're probably on their way out. You have like junior partners who are like the up and coming people who are like probably not doing a lot of the work, at least as much as a partner does, and like getting paid less than the senior partners. And then you have like a bunch of people trying to make partner. And those are the people who are actually doing all the work and getting paid the least and don't have any sort of like profits interest in the company. So it goes in a lot of different directions. Like I think when it comes to a fund, it's a little different than like a law firm or like an accounting firm or something like that. But like, I think overall, like I'm a partner at Figment Capital. I'm on the investment team. And I think it's helpful for like certain conversations. Like if you're having a conversation with so if I would introduce myself as managing partner to like a potential investor, mostly because I'm a little older and because I've done most of the conversations with our LPs and done most of the fundraising, like not all of it, but most of it. And so like, it's helpful for them to kind of be able to like, you know, put some sort of like label on like who I am and what my role here is. But like ultimately,
and like managing partner is the one at the top. Like there's like no role above managing partner, right? Okay. Can there only be one or can there be like more than one?
No, there can be multiple, right? Like, so there might be a fund called Perillo and DeLuca, right? And like, so presumably Perillo and DeLuca are like the founding partners of the fund. And so we're the managing partners. And we have like other partners below us, right? That are like, we hired an analyst and he got promoted through the ranks and now he's like made partner. And so now he has an equity interest, but like that person would not be, in this case, this is really by title. Like this is just like a ceremonial thing. Like there's no difference between myself and Dougie.
Let me ask you this. So like, I know that like for you guys, it's like a relatively small, like extremely lean operation. But in the context of like most of like the larger crypto VC funds, would it be correct in thinking that like if you're a partner, then you have upside exposure to all of the deals? Whereas if you're like an analyst or an associate or whatever title they want to give them, then for those people, they would maybe have a salary, but they would also have upside just for the deals that they're a part of, is like carry on just the deals they bring in. Is that the right mental model?
So it's a great question. I think it's highly dependent on the structure of the entity, and it can be completely different for every single one of them, right? You could have funds that actually do it like deal by deal. And like, so again, like this is kind of going into my background before this was accounting. And I did a bunch of like allocations for like partnership allocations. Like where does the money, as you earn money in a company, like who gets what? And how do you allocate the income amongst all these different parties? And I think it just depends, frankly. The simple answer is it depends, which is a non-answer, kind of a punt. But like you can have it where the investor, like the person who brings in the deal and leads the deal, like they only get access to like the gains from that. You could have one where you share them all, right? Like depending, like you have a percentage and like whatever the fund makes, you get a cut of that. There's even like for much, much, much bigger funds that have like multiple funds and even maybe multiple like verticals. Like they're in like, they have a healthcare fund, they have a technology fund, they have a crypto fund, they have a real estate fund, where like actually all the partners don't actually benefit, like nobody benefits from like the performance of a single fund, but rather they do this like really crazy thing where like everybody just gets a bonus, which is like this, like they put all the money in a pool and go like, okay, so it's 2023. The crypto fund didn't do well, but the real estate fund did very well. Like let's put all that money together and say, okay, your cut is like this percentage of across all these funds. Right. And then like, hey, in 2025, like the crypto fund did really well. And, I don't know, the biotech fund didn't do very well. So like, and then that kind of is more of like a, what we call like peanut butter, right? Cause like you're just kind of like spreading it and you're saying like, okay, like you're getting kind of just like a cut of everything. So it can be as like, it can be, you can use a scalpel or you can use, you know, a sledgehammer, I guess, like, or like a peanut butter. And so I think we're kind of, it depends. And different things work. I think there's like show me the incentives and I'll show you the results, right? Or I'll tell you how it will end up. And so I think there's like ways in which like both can work really well. And I think there's ways in which like those incentives like maybe create challenges for people working at the company or disincentives for some people working at the company.
That makes a lot of sense to me. I think that like for me, when I was newer to being a founder and when I was like newer to pitching VCs, I noticed that there was this common pattern where I would talk to like a junior partner or an investment analyst or a specialist or whatever. And it would be very easy for me to go through the pitch deck with them and they'd be on board. And then they'd be like, all right, yeah, man, I was told this a lot. I just need to convince IC, or I just need to convince the managing partner. And then these people would just struggle to convince the managing partner. And when I was newer, I would very arrogantly assume that it's just because this person did a bad job of explaining what we do to the managing partner or like during the investment committee. I think now that I'm a little bit more like jaded, I'm starting to realize that the incentives for a lot of these things are a little bit more like misaligned, where it's like if someone has a deal, they want IC to approve it. So they get like the upside carry if they don't have like carry on the full fund. Or maybe it was just that it was like harder for these like technical juniors to convince their boomer seniors on like the more technical stuff of our deck. Maybe I was right to a certain extent. Maybe it's a mix of both. But I've always found like the flow through the VC like company to be something that's tricky to navigate. And I've always wanted to learn more about like as a founder on the other side of the table, how I can like optimize it and how I can approach it, especially with like the technical stuff.
Yeah, I guess like a lot of things are relationship based, right? I think like it's going to be hard for me to kind of, I can tell you how it works here, right? Which is like, I'm very hands on. Like, you know, okay, so we're investors in Fastlane, right? I get like caveat here. And so, you know, we've known each other for like over a year now, well over a year. And then we've been investors for well over a year as well. We've known each other, I think, before we invested for a little while or knew of each other. And like you can tell, right? Like that, like sometimes I'll take a call first or Dougie will take a call first. And then just to like kind of vet the idea, the team, the founder, right? The like the product, the protocol, whatever it may be. And then if there's, if like we like it, if there's something there, right? Like we generally like hop on another call and be like, hey, Dougie, like this is, I think there's something here, right? Or Dougie, like Jim, I think there's something here. Like we should talk to these guys again. And so we'll schedule another call. And like, I'll be somewhat, there'll be a deck or there'll be like an investment memo or something like that. And then like we both talk to you together, right? And so like you're getting to know the team. And like we also don't have like, so for these bigger funds, some of them have like a like portfolio support team, right? Which like my assumption is like the founder never hears about the portfolio support team or ever meets anybody on the portfolio support team prior to receiving an investment from the fund, right? So you don't even know, that's a person you don't even know. We don't have like, hello, I am the portfolio support team. Like, hello, Dougie is the portfolio support team. So like, I think for us, we're building a relationship with the founders from the very beginning. You're going to like, and I think that's part of like part of our special sauce actually, is that like, you get to know us and how we're going to work and how we work. And we get to know you and how you work. And we can decide both on both sides of the table, like whether we think we're going to work well together, in addition to whether we think this is like a good investment or whether this is like a good opportunity for us to like collaborate, right? In whatever way. And sometimes it leads to investment and sometimes it doesn't lead to investment, but that doesn't mean that the relationship ends. And I think having a relationship with like, so if you're a founder and you're listening to this, right? I think one of the things is like, you kind of want to always try to be getting as close to like the decision makers as possible. It might be hard. But the more that you can talk to decision makers versus like a first year intern, you know what I mean? Like the more likely it is that like you're actually having, you're getting questions fielded. You're fielding questions that like, that managing partner or may have, right? And I think that one of the hardest things is like the questions that you like, especially early on in your career, it sounds like you're probably getting a lot of questions from analysts, less experienced people. And they don't know all the right questions to ask or the questions that the partner is going to ask in IC. And so they're asking all the questions they think are the best questions and to understand. And they're missing some of the questions and they actually have never asked the questions that like the IC, the investment committee, wants to know in order to like be able to fully understand the opportunity without having ever talked to or spoken to anyone on the team about their go-to-market, about what the protocol does, about the company, about your experience. And what we found more recently is that like, I think founders are becoming a little bit more aware of this, let's say.
It's interesting that you say that, because I think that, like, as you know, but as the listeners might not, I run a lot of ideas by you. Like from my point of view, there's two people that I really trust to tell me that I shouldn't do something if I think it's something I want to do. And that's you and Kyle Samani. It's like a lot of other people, like especially if they're like less invested or less involved, might not risk breaking like rapport with me or like offending me by telling me that I've got a bad idea. As you know, I have a lot of bad ideas. But other people don't know that, because other people only see the post-filtered ideas. And so like for me, being able to run stuff by people like you and Kyle, even if I disagree with like your take, like you might tell me not to do something and I still might do it anyway. Yeah. But like having that like network, I think is like very, very important. And I think like from my point of view, like you guys like being very proactive and taking on that role even before you had invested in us was, actually Multicoin did that too. It was like a really, really cool thing. And I think that like a lot of founders just kind of like go into this thinking that like they have to pitch their vision to VCs. Whereas like, and I'm like realizing this as I'm saying it, but like a lot, pretty much every, it's like you guys have led and Multicoin's led and DBA led, but DBA, I think they were kind of like a co-lead with y'all. Yep. Love DBA to death. Yes, but like with you guys and Multicoin, it was kind of like, converging on like a shared strategy more so than like me selling to you guys, which just meant like, you know, figuring that out together and just like having the trust to like just have frank conversations.
Yeah. I mean, I love it. It's been a great relationship. It's one of my favorites, amongst a lot of really great relationships. And it's nice when it happens. I think like another way of like putting it is like, okay, so we have investors as well, right? This isn't like a prop capital fund, like where it's like me and Dougie's money, right? And so I think we fall victim to it too, which is like, you think that the people invest in you because you have all the answers and that like, that's why they're investing in you. And that like, they just expect you to just like know everything and do everything. And this is like not the way the real world works, right? And I think what you realize really quickly is like, people want to help. Sometimes they just don't know how to. And then also some people don't want to help. Right. And so I think like you can kind of test the waters and they'll be called upon at times to like help and like get advice and like, and like, I view them always as like a test of like, whether or not we're like, I don't know what I'm saying here other than like, I think like a lot of times maybe founders think that like they're supposed to have all the answers and we don't expect you to have all the answers. A lot of this is like we're building the plane, you know, in midair, and asking for help is one of those things that like, or advice or however you want to frame it, is not a weakness. It's actually a strength. And knowing what you know and knowing what you don't know and asking people to like, give insight on things you don't know, and maybe some things you don't even know you don't know, is like always really, I think, really helpful, because like there are people who are more experienced, there are people that have been there before, and again, like just building out your network again is going to be super valuable. There's founders who will tell you, don't do that, I did that, you know. And there's going to be VCs that say like, well, you know, the question is like, do you ask why, right? Why not, or why, or why not? And like, I can tell you, like, you could give me some idea and I could be like, that's a terrible idea, don't do that. And if that's like the end of the conversation, then like, okay, I don't know what I really got from this conversation, I don't know what I've contributed. But like, if we take the time to kind of go through it, like one of two things will happen, right? Like, or one of three things will happen, probably four, but whatever. Like the first is like, I was wrong, right? Like you explain your side of things. And like, you explain to me like why this is a good idea. And I go, you know what? I've been convinced. Like, you're actually right. Like, this is a great idea. Like, I was looking at it wrong. Like I've learned something, right? I've been able to change my mind. Separately, I explain why, like in the past, like this is something that hasn't worked and why it hasn't worked and why it might be like suboptimal. And you go, that makes a ton of sense. Like, thanks for looking out. Like, that just saved me a ton of time and like going down the wrong path. Or the opposite, right? Which is like, we just disagree, or like, this is a good idea, I think it's a good idea, and you think it's a bad idea, or like, I think it's a bad idea and you think it's a good idea, and we can't agree on it, right? But at least you have like some informed opinion of like where we're coming from, and I have a formed opinion about where you're coming from. And it's like, okay, well, like, how do I help you anyway? Like, how do I help you anyway with this? Or I think this is a good idea. And it's like, well, noted, thank you, I understand why, but like, that's just like not on the roadmap. It's like, okay, got it.
If you disagree with something and we end up doing it anyway, just the fact that like, I know you disagree with it gives me a lot of time to prepare to counter the objections that I know like other VCs will have too. Like, yeah. I know that if I run an idea by you or by Kyle, like, you guys will object. Like, and if other VCs are thinking it but not willing to say it, I feel like that's how a lot of these like deals can get blown up, where it's like I really like talking to like people that'll just like, you know, tell you how they see it. They're not worried about like, you know, alignment. And, like, some people have this thing where it's like they can't be friends with people they disagree with. I think these people have like never played a sport before in their life.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you can be friends off the field, you know. The two are totally unrelated, but like some people, I don't know.
We're working towards the same thing, right? Which is like the success of the company. And like, that is like the ultimate goal here. And like, that's a team, right? And so like, yeah, maybe these people who have never like who can't be friends with people like they played like golf and tennis, which are like solo person sports, right? But like where like you can just like hate literally everybody else that you play with. But like frankly, when it comes to like the sports that I played at least, like there were people I did not like on my team and there were people I disagreed with on my team, and like we all still like celebrated in the win. And
Yes.
like I think you got to be able to celebrate the wins and you got to be able to like share the losses and like not point the finger, because like that just doesn't help anybody's morale, and it doesn't help you prepare for success down the road and eventually. So like I think it's, yeah, I think that's good. I think another, like I don't know whether to touch on this or not, but I'm just going to touch on it, which is like I think sometimes like pivoting is like another thing that founders sometimes have to do, or maybe even like just calling, like kind of like they've raised money, right? Like there's they're kind of just like not finding success, or like they've pivoted once or twice and they're still kind of just out there trying to figure out like this isn't really, they're not really passionate about the idea, but they feel like they have to go on. And I think like they feel like that's what the investors want from them. And so like not only are they not having fun or passionate about what they're doing, but they have all this pressure they think, because like they think investors like just want them to like try to figure it out and just keep going and keep going and keep going. And what I would say there is like to be as like emotionally intelligent here as possible is like, look, like we invested like money. It's like some of it's our money, some of it's like our LP's money. And like ultimately, like if there's a way to like it's hard to say like we're gonna pivot. It's hard to say like, you know what, this just isn't working. But it's like a very mature thing to do if like it just isn't working. And to the extent that like you can make that hard decision and you can return some money back to investors rather than burn through it all and then go, I guess it didn't work out, you know? And like, and how long ago did you know? I knew 2 years ago that it wasn't going to work out, but like, I just kept trying because like, that's what the investors want. Like in reality, that's not what the investors want, right? They don't want that for you, and they don't want that for their own investor. Their investors, like my investors, don't also want that. And so I think like having a relationship with your investors, like where you can kind of have that conversation, we've had it with a few of our portfolio companies, and like you don't have to give the money back, you don't have to do that, but like you don't have to close up. But like when it's hard, but like I think it's like oftentimes like sometimes it's the right thing to do, and like you should talk about it and have a conversation, frank conversation with people about it. And like it could like be stressful for you, it could relieve stress from you, it could relieve stress from us, it could relieve stress from like everybody, and save people some money also.
That's dude, that's my nightmare scenario is I think like different people prioritize different things. For me, my most precious commodity is my time. And to spend like years of my life working on something that I know is not going to be wildly successful is like the worst possible thing that I could like imagine. I think like for
Samesies.
us, like we have changed like ecosystems. We went from Polygon to like multi-chain with application sequencing, and we still have the application sequencing on multiple chains. We're just not launching a token or like leading distribution there, but the tech's there, but like we're not like integrated with those like chains, like social layers. And like, you know, some people would say that like us going from like Polygon to multi-chain to like Monad is a pivot. For us, it's like it's all the same code base. And so I don't think we could have like, you know, returned and then re-raised anyway without like getting our asses sued off. But like even if we did, like I wouldn't want to like fire a bunch of people and then rehire them to do the exact same thing with like a slightly different, you know, color. Like so I think like for us it was like a pivot but like also not. But like dude, so like if we were working on something and like I didn't have like high conviction that it would lead to like at least like for me like unless like the companies worth like at least a billion, then I'm just like, all right, that's not exciting. Because I know like you guys are typically looking for like at least like 100x's, right? Especially because you guys got in super early for us. But like in general, you guys are looking for like really high returns and just expecting most like teams to fail, right?
I mean, not really. I think like at least 100x's is like an interesting phrase. Like I think most people who get a 100x return are pretty happy. And
That's fair.
hopefully you have a couple of them, right? A couple, and then like, but like, you know, I think there's a bunch of people, you know, there's a bunch of numbers and metrics and facts out there about like, you're a VC and you have like two investments and they can carry your entire fund because they're like just such blowout wins. I think, yeah, of course, like we want every investment we make to be like a 100x. I think that also depends on like where, what stage you invest in. I think generally. And so we invest in like an earlier stage. And so like a lot of times we see outcomes that we think are going to be, we think are going to be really big if they take off. That does mean that like it's like high risk, high reward. A lot of them are going to just ultimately go to zero, just by just the odds that exist and they're real. But I think we go in like thinking like this is a really great team. We're really excited to support them. I think sometimes it's like this is something that we think. I don't know whether we always think it's going to be 100x return, but I think there's often times where we're like, this is something that's going to be critical to, the ecosystem that they're building in, and there could be an outsized return for investing in that company, even if it's at like a higher valuation. But I think it goes into like there's like a lot of things that we could talk about like on valuation side and stuff like that. But like,
Let's dig into
but we,
that.
okay.
Let's dig into that. So in TradFi, there's this concept of like a debt rating ceiling, where if a company is headquartered in a country that has like a double A rating on their bonds, like the country's bonds, like like treasury bills or whatever, the rule is that corporate bonds issued from like a company in that country, the rating of the corporate bonds can never exceed the rating of the country's own bonds. I don't remember the exact reason why, but it makes sense. Question for you is, would you say that there's something similar to that with apps that are building inside of like an ecosystem?
Well, it's hard. I mean, if you have we seen any applications that are more valuable? Like, I guess like you're getting at a couple different things, like when it comes to crypto, like all at the same time, right? I think the first thing is like L1 premium we could talk about, right? Because like there's historically been these like premiums on the value of like investing in an L1, and that L1s are like just like $1 billion valuation, right? And like they're over $1 billion valuation. They're $90 billion. They're $300 billion, right? They're $50 billion. And then therefore, if that's like the value of like the network, and the network token, like can any application like supersede that and be more valuable than that? I think to date that hasn't taken place. I would say that like, and it's hard to know, frankly, right? Like if this can happen. Actually, I guess I don't know what the, not to like name names, like I don't know what the current valuation of Polygon is, but Polymarket is on Polygon and no one really like, and so I don't, and I think Poly market is currently, like raising around at a fairly high valuation. Like this could be the first example of an application who is actually like more valuable than the network that it's on. I think over time we'll see more and more of that, which means one of two things, and they're not mutually exclusive, which is that like the L1 premium and or L2 premium will begin to just fall, and like the value of like an L1 or an L2 token is like less valuable than it was in the past, which is probably a sign of maturity of like investing. And then the second thing is that like applications that have really widespread adoption wind up being like massively valuable, and like the revenue that they can generate on a global scale is so high that they command a higher valuation than the L1 or L2 is value that they're on. I mean, this goes also to like economic security, whether it's a meme or whether it's not a meme. But I don't know. I want to look up the numbers of like of what the example that I just gave, and
It
maybe
sounds
we're looking at the
plausible.
first example. But it should happen. It could happen. It should happen. And I think like finding those like interesting applications is like a worthwhile endeavor, and we should be funding those types of teams.
You had mentioned that the L1 premium seems to be decreasing and that was a sign of a more mature market. Can you elaborate on the connection there between like the market's maturity and the L1 premium decreasing?
Yeah, I mean, a little bit, right? So I think number one is like something that's been highly debated and to ad nauseum is like, are you like REV and like what kind of like revenue is the L1 generating? I think what we're also seeing is like back in the day, like which is not that long ago, like anybody who spun up an L1 can get like $1 billion. Congratulations, you built a consensus, like a consensus machine that like a computer, a world computer of some kind. And just by doing so, like you are going to be able to be your network will be worth like billions and billions of dollars. And I think what we've seen is, and there's Cosmos, which is like more like application specific blockchains. We've continued to see this rollout of like L1s and L1s and L1s and L1 ecosystems with like their general purpose, smart contract enabled blockchains. And what we've seen, there's a few examples that have like kind of come out recently where the launches have been, I think, based on all of the hype around them, have been underwhelming, let's say, and like are currently per like the value of them at this stage, at this early stage, is lower than like the last round that they raised at, or that like, you know, they did around a investment round where it was like at a high valuation, and like, yes, it's above the valuation that like investors last invested in, but it's not like a 10 or 20x like return over that valuation. And so which means like either, you know, and like there's complaints and discussions around like, is there just too much block space that's like not that valuable? Are there too many L1s? Are there too many L2s? And I think like, you know, time will tell. I think there's still plenty of room for L1s, and I think there's still plenty of room for L2s. Otherwise, like Monad wouldn't be building one, and also like Robinhood wouldn't be building one, respectively. I think we'll see, but I think at the same time, like you know, the jig is up a little bit on like, you know, just launch an L1 and like you will have a very high valuation. I think people are starting to say like, okay, well, what can I do here? What exists here? What's different? What's new? What's fresh? How are you getting users? How are you attracting users? How are you growing the pie? Which I think our industry has been very it's like just kind of the same money sloshing around and going from ecosystem to ecosystem to ecosystem to ecosystem. And we're not like growing the number of like users. And so I think if you can unlock some of those things, like it should like grow the pie for everybody. And I think like there'll be a lot of applications that have a lot of usage. And I think that ultimately leads to like higher valuations for applications. It could also just include like higher valuations for companies launching L2s and networks that have an L1 token. But like, I guess what I'm saying is just building an L1 for the sake of building an L1 has become, I guess, less indicative that you're just going to have like a $1 billion outcome as a founder from day one. There's a lot of work that's involved, I think, in doing that and like actually like earning that valuation. Most of the time.
I have a bunch of questions. I think you touched on like a lot of different subjects there, but I think the most spicy question I have on that subject is like the concept of just like launching an L1 that has no users that has like a $1 billion valuation. Like there are ways to capture that value back if you own a bunch of the token.
Yeah, there is.
In terms of like the valuation, but do you see like a lot of these founders selling their own like shares or like equity or whatever you want to call it in like OTC markets, or like why do you think people keep doing it?
Well, it's still the premium still exists, and so
where does that money come from? Where does that money come from though?
Yeah, why do people keep doing it? Is because it's still the premium still exists. I'm joking a little bit.
I'm a shady L1 founder. I launch an L1. I'm like, yeah, it's worth $3 billion. Here's a bunch of people that like, you know, retweeted our announcement generic bullshit pitch deck.
Sure.
So I get a bunch of VCs in. I can make money by selling OTC to like other VCs. Sure. The premium comes from the fact that like these VCs are coming in. And my like these VCs, they make money by selling to like retail users on centralized exchanges, I'm assuming. But aren't the VCs typically like locked up, like restricted from selling for a while?
VCs are locked up, so is team, right? And like generally speaking, it's not always. The team is on a longer lockup period than the VCs are, or investors. Like it's not just VCs. There's angel invest. There's individuals also, right? There's like angel investors. Sometimes there's like echo rounds now. ICOs have historically like had no unlock, but there could be lockups for like ICO, I guess. But I don't think so. I think that's like a kind of like an echo round, like a crowdfunded round. There's a bunch of reasons why those tokens are like usually locked up for over a year and then like vesting. And there's been some discussions on that, a couple of Telegram chats I'm in about what's better. I think
who's left holding the bag? Like where does the money come from that supports the premium at the top of the funnel?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of different places it comes from. Ideally, ideally like no one ever sells, right? 3-3. And we all just like ride to Valhalla and together. I was just thinking yesterday about how much I actually miss like all the 3-3s on my timeline, because like at least it was like people were like not trying to rug each other. People were like trying to like get rich together, and now it feels like everyone's trying to rug each other. Maybe it's just a sign of the times. But like trying to get out first is like how it feels sometimes. I guess like, so Mosi Vanacharma had a pretty good article for about 1L1 specifically, and like how they were able to maintain their premium. I would recommend people just go and check that out. That's like one way. So it generally comes, but like, I think what one thing that you're touching on is like every round, right, that like is raised at a certain valuation sort of like sets the floor, let's call it, like, right? And so valuations are going up, and then it's like hopefully and for the team and the founders, you know, there's also this other entity and or entities which are like the centralized exchanges and the market makers, and they have, I wrote a couple articles about market making, and I like published them on my, I don't really like have like a personal blog or anything, so I just kind of posted them on like a PDF file that people can like review. So I did it like very old school, and you know, like I think you can read that there's various ways that people can like, I would say ideally temporarily maintain that premium before like the house of cards kind of falls down. Like I think at some point you do need to have like actual users. I think you do need to have like real applications. I think you do need to have a token economy that like works and is like working for the ecosystem, that like the token economy. And if it's all just kind of smoke and mirrors, like eventually either it gets called out, eventually investors get wise, eventually retail gets wise. The proliferation of like perps have allowed people to short things to like zero. So I think there's like, so people can vote with their money now, but like, I think there's a lot of ways where people can be held accountable, but also at the same time, like there's a lot of money to like that can like kind of like sustain something and keep it up because they benefit from it in an outsized way. And so it's hard to like really ever get to the, like you can kind of tell when something weird is happening. I think I would also argue that like these treasury, these DATs are the newest example of a way of like stopping investor tokens and like unlocks from hitting the open market. I'm very skeptical of a lot of these DATs, which is the digital asset treasury is what it stands for. It's like these publicly traded companies. It's all the rage this month. And this is just all this is financial engineering, right? Ultimately.
How does it stop the sales from hitting the market? Because I do think that's like a really important thing, right? Like how do you make it so that people exit without tanking the price? That's kind of like, you know, how long can you keep the charade going on? Like what's the mechanism through which the DATs prolong that?
So we haven't participated in any. So I'll first say that. And a lot of this is like secondhand information, right? So and just also like instinctively, like how do I think it works, right? So like take this with a grain of salt, right? Do your DYOR, and like I'm not like saying that they're like not good, or I don't actually have an opinion on whether they're good or bad. I'm just sort of explaining
on it.
Okay, so do I. And I think like there's a lot of ways that these can be built and is built out and structured, and it actually ultimately comes down to the structuring. It's still like my guess is you know Blockworks is doing this like transparency report. I think now there's like Blockworks research has done like this like. Or I think, they've done a DAT dashboard. I think Delphi may also have one where they're like tracking these DATs and to try to be as high level as possible and not get super into the weeds. The question just becomes of like, how does the company acquire the tokens? That is like the question you need to ask. And if you can find out the answer to that, that's great. Like, are they buying them? Are they buying them from the open market? Like, so a company raises, I'll just use a really random number, so I'm not like calling anyone out. A company like somehow has this like offering and raises $100 million, right? Okay, cool. They have $100 million that they raised. Did they raise cash? Did they accept in-kind contributions of the token? So there's like what percentage is cash? Which percentage is in-kind contributions, right? So in-kind contributions means that like, rather than accept cash, they accepted tokens into it and like gave people shares of a publicly traded company in exchange for tokens. So how much is cash? How much is in-kind contributions of tokens? Are the tokens locked or are the tokens unlocked? Who is contributing the tokens? All of this is like very, at this stage, I think not clear on most of these. And then like if they have cash, let's take two examples, like the most extreme examples. The first example is that like there's been no cash contributed. Everybody has contributed tokens, and then everybody who contributed tokens has shares and the tokens are locked. The investor like has locked tokens. They somehow transfer those locked tokens to a company. The company now holds locked tokens. They get shares and they sell the shares, right? So like they just have like dumped on retail, but on Wall Street. The other version of it is that, and that's like pretty egregious, I would say, right? The other version of it, the least egregious way of doing it is like, we raise cash, we think this is undervalued, and we're going to buy all the tokens on the open market, maybe not right away in like one big slam of the button, but like over time, we're gonna just buy the tokens as we think it's undervalued. And we've made like an initial investment of $25 million, which we're going to do over the next like month or two. And then from there, we're going to kind of just be a little bit more like selective of like when we buy. But like the goal is for us to like spend all $100 million and do this like and hold this because we think it's like very valuable long term. And then those are the two ends of the spectrum. And then there's everything in between, right? Is it investors that are contributing? Is it the foundation that's contributing? Is it the founders that are contributing? Is it like who is contributing the tokens, right? That's like essentially, it's a lot of that's like unclear, and it's not in the. I haven't read all the public documentation, but like of every single one of these. But those are like sort of the questions you should be asking, and how are they going to continue to buy the tokens or acquire the tokens?
That makes sense. You mentioned like the foundation there. Foundations, it's something that I'm like fascinating right now is kind of at that stage where we're really having to think a lot about this kind of thing. Like from your perspective, it feels like foundations can either be like, you know, very strict in some ways. They can have like large roles. They can have small roles. You know, they can be, you know, huge corruption mechanisms, or they can just be like actual like useful governance things. It seems like they're very like vague, very, very open-ended, and they've evolved a lot over the like last few years too. I can't remember who it was, but like he wrote a piece on how the foundations might not even be necessary in the future.
Because like, Miles Jennings.
Realistically, they were. Yeah, that's it. That's it. Yes, because they were like basically regulatory arbitrage, like originally. And it's like question for you is like a lot of stuff these days, especially a lot of the shady stuff, seems like it in some way or another involves the foundation. I mean, dude, even for us, when we're like talking to validators and like, you know, working the like inside of an ecosystem, like the foundation plays an absolutely just outsized role in so much of this stuff. Like, what are your thoughts on just the way that foundations are evolving? And it's like a follow-up question would be, what are your thoughts on how applications should interact with and kind of like handle and navigate these environments going forward?
So the article is like really worth reading. It does point out a lot of like the complexities of like having a labs entity, which like continues to like build out the technology, right? That like domiciled in a company, a country. And then you also have this like foundation entity that is supposedly nonprofit. Foundations are, I guess there could be for-profit foundations. I don't think so. I think they're generally nonprofit.
I think it depends on the country they're based in.
Yeah. And then there's a bunch of like really bizarre things that happen, right? Like, so some people like move over to the foundation that used to work at labs. Like there's like these like walls that are created like between like labs and foundation where like they're not supposed to talk. Like you have to like move people off the Slack and like add them to the other Slack. And like, it's kind of like the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. And it's really confusing. And I think it's like very, like, it's like regulatory arbitrage, like you said. I think, you know, as much as I think having like a single entity and like having it be a corporate entity that does this is, that handles a lot of this stuff, like makes a lot of sense. There's a lot of reasons why. I think like part of the other reason is like tax arbitrage, if I had to guess, because like when you, if you raise money at like a high valuation and then you like mint a token, my assumption is that like there's a pretty good argument that there's just been like this like revenue, like this like wealth creation, and that like this corporation just received like a massive windfall, and like they have to pay taxes on it, but like of course the tokens are locked and they can't sell like their taxes, they can't sell the tokens to like pay the taxes on this. So there's also that aspect of this, amongst a bunch of other things. But like, I think in general, it would be great if there was some clarity on this. It would be great if like we didn't have to go through this like song and dance every single time. I'm interested to see like who does it first. Presumably it would be like a portfolio company from the entity that wrote the article. Like my biggest concern is that like, cause like, go ahead and show us the way, you know, like go ahead and do it. Like, you know, great to put out this thing. Great to say funds or sorry, companies should do this. Great to say
founders. 16Z, right?
Yes. Correct. Great to say that founders and like company, like they should be thinking about this stuff and doing this stuff. But like, okay, cool. Put your money where your mouth is, right? Like have one of your teams like go ahead and go through this process and let us know how it goes. Because like I think a couple things happened, right? The first thing that happened after that was like everybody was talking about it. We had a lot of founders like reach out to us. We're not as well resourced as that firm, right? By any means, as any stretch of the imagination. And so they're like, what do you think about this? So now we're like kind of thinking about it and I think and talking about it and trying to give advice and like let's talk to our lawyers and like maybe you talk to your lawyers. So we're like spending money on resources on this article. The second part about it is that like I hope that the direction that this, that like from a regulatory perspective, that the US is taking continues into the future. But like pendulum swing, and like the decisions that one makes in one like administration doesn't necessarily always carry over to the next. And I didn't really see anything in that piece about like the risks. And like, I would argue that that's like one of the risks is like, okay, well, what happens if in like 3 years, there's somebody who's like super anti crypto that becomes the president of the United States. And like, sorry, bro, like you read this article and like YOLO'd it. And now you're stuck with the consequences of those actions. So I think like that would have been good to see. That would have been good. Like, I think, you know, this is what we think, and like, but here are some of the risks involved. It's always a good thing to have in a document. And then like also like please show us the way. Like, I would love for like the best resource fund in the world in crypto to like, or one of them at least, to like guide the way, like lead the way, and like show us how to do it. And like, that would be great. And then let's see what happens. And assuming no one gets sued or like, you know, arrested for securities, something like, great. It looks like it's go time. Like we can continue to do this.
Speaking of the advice
essentially that we gave was like, hey, like this is a great piece. It's very thoughtful. At the same time, like this is not law, and this is not like, this is like just an opinion piece. And you should treat it like an opinion piece and not follow it to the tooth and nail, because like, you're not going to be able to like point to this person and say like, this was legal advice. It's not legal advice. And yeah, that's kind of the case.
Like, speaking of regulatory risk, as a founder, I do always try to keep in mind that there's asymmetric regulatory risk when it comes to stuff like this. You know, VCs don't necessarily have the same, you know, downsides of violating certain regulations as the companies they're investing in. But I also think that, like, I mean, this is crypto. Anytime you're dealing with new technology, there's always regulatory risk, because they can always make something illegal after the fact, right? There's always that look back. And so, a question for you, how do you look at things like regulatory risk in the context of underwriting companies that are coming to you trying to get funded? Like, how do you think about it? And more importantly, like, how do you look at that company specifically compared to other companies?
It's a good question. Very good question, Alex.
The only kind I have.
I mean, I would say that like, you're very thoughtful about the regulatory risk. Sometimes I think maybe a little too thoughtful about it.
Not me. I worked in TradFi for a little cautious, over a decade. You know? I do have a chip on my shoulder there, but like,
yeah, I mean, I think
regardless of me in general, for like companies that you're looking at investing in, like, how would you evaluate, like what would you like to see? What scares you away?
Yeah. I mean, I think like there are rewards for, you know, being risk on. And I think that for investing, I think it's for starting a company, pushing the boundaries, right? I think if you're willing to push the boundaries, like in general, like there are risks and there are rewards, right? And I think if you're willing to take those risks, like then, and you're successful, like, you will be able to like afford to defend yourself, right? Essentially. So like the worst thing is to like, there's a ton of examples of this where like, you know, a company gets a big round of funding, like this thing that's made them really successful, right? Which is like moving fast, like breaking things, right? Like getting adoption, like, which is so hard to do, finding product market fit. Like, they did this, they were young, they were scrappy, they were hustled, they got to this point, like, congratulations, like, we've kind of hit this like this opportunity where like, we think this thing is going to be really big. And then I think this is like the example I'll give, right? Which is like kind of like this like other side of it, which, and then what happens is like, then you do this big round, You just made a massive round. Congratulations. You just raised a ton of capital. And new investors on the cap table, maybe they've put a lot of money in, like at a very high valuation. They're worried about their investment, and the risk of like their investment, from like a going concern perspective. And then they like say like, oh, like you should talk to lawyers. You should talk to legal about that. And all of a sudden, like they lawyer up, right? And like ultimately what happens is it creates like stasis and like just like the company is not able to like move at the same speed that they were able to move before, and they sort of lose momentum. And like you're like, man, what changed? Like as soon as they raised that money, they must have like cashed out or something like that, right? And like just stopped caring. And it's like, well, maybe that's what happened. Also, what might have happened is like they started getting a bunch of lawyer, like legal, like opinions about stuff, and like and they just kept telling them they couldn't do things. Like you can't do that. You can't do that. You can't do that. And I have like many examples of this, and not just in like crypto protocols and L1s and L2s and whatever middleware or whatever applications. Like also like corporations, this also happens, right? Like they get a little bit more cautious, and I think being cautious is like a good thing, just to be clear here, because like there is a lot of money on the line, but at the same time, like it can actually like stagnate or slow you down or actually move you in the wrong direction. And there's a lot of people who made decisions based on like I mentioned, like what happens when like a new president comes into office in the United States if they're anti-crypto. But there's a lot of people who made a lot of decisions based on Joe Biden being the president of the United States last year, right? And then like all of a sudden, like Trump's in office and like he's very pro-crypto. And like all of a sudden, like you can be off sides on both sides, right? And they're like, oh, I guess we should have like IPO'd last year. Oh, I guess we could have ICO'd, and we didn't. I guess we could talk about DeFi or yield or whatever the thing is, right? And we just like didn't do that, and we lost like that momentum that we had. And as a result, like our share price is like now in the toilet, or our token price is like not doing as well, or like we're starting to lose employees that went to other things because like this was just like not the company that they had started at and that they were so used to working at, right? And something kind of like got in the way of that. And so I think like, you have to kind of thread that needle, and it's going to be different for everybody, and it's hard to do, but like essentially like you're a founder of a company, right? You're like the visionary of the company, and like you should be making the decisions, right? Not the lawyers. And if the lawyers are like your head of strategy, then like something has really happened like wrong with the direction of the company, I would argue. And like that's not how you should be making strategic decisions, is like the lawyer said we can't do that every single time, or like let me check with the lawyer before we decide to like change our website or something. You know what I mean? Like there's certain things that like you just say like, look, I'm like, we're not going to do that. We're going to move forward in this direction. We're just going to do this, and we'll take the risk.
Fair enough. Let me ask you. So like, I think that's like a really prudent thing for like founders as like, strategy. And I agree with that, even though we do check with our lawyers before we put certain things on the
Yeah, of
website.
course, as you should.
I guess like for founders that are like going through the capital raise right now, like, are there things that you do to like look for this? Are there like signs? Are there like questions that you ask? If I'm a founder, and I want to like, convey to you that I'm not just like, run by lawyers, like what would be the things I should focus on, like messaging?
I don't know what kind of company this is. It sounds interesting.
Let's say
Yeah, for this
it's a
hypothetical company.
DEX, because a DEX probably has more regulatory risk than a lot of other types.
I mean, so like for example, right? We're an early stage company, right? We're like pre-seed. Like, do I think that you've gotten a legal opinion on like whether this is like, do I think you've gotten a legal opinion on whether you could just, of course not. Like you're like trying to build something and like have it have product market fit. What we would do on our side at that point is like we'll run a back, like if we're going to invest, like, or we're interested in investing, like we'll run a background check on you probably to like make sure you haven't like stolen money or done anything like that. Like we want obviously the code to be audited, and we're going to like really push like as hard as we possibly can for like you to like get audits for your code base. I think beyond that, I mean, like, look, like, let's look in the history of all the dexes and all the world, and like, you know, I feel like I don't know what would stop us. Like, I think it's more you want to invest in people who are bold and visionary and are going to like, that's like, that's going to be, that's always going to resonate. Right. And if you, I think like maybe one thing is like, one thing that would just come up would be like, if we're like sharing ideas, like, oh, we can't do that. 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 It's like, why? And say, well, like, what, why can't you do that? Like, why can't you do any of the things we just talked about? And I think, well, what if, you know, what if this happens? Like, what if this happens? Like, what if X happens or Y happens or Z happens? And it's like, well, all right, then like, why are you doing this? why are you building this? Like, it doesn't even seem like it's something that like you're willing to like put your name on and to like really see through the vision of like how big this can be or this opportunity can be, or like, it sounds like you're nervous or you're scared to like actually build it without all these safeguards. Like, how do you think you're going to get users? And then like the answer is like, well, I don't know. And you're like, how do you get users if it's like a lockbox and like all the stuff is inside and is like hard to get to? Like, how do you make it easier for people to use it? Like, the idea of crypto in general is that like it's public, it's open, people can just use it. And like, as soon as you start to like make it harder and harder and harder to like for anyone to access something, like the more kind of like barriers you're setting up for yourself, that you're going to have like really great strategy for like breaking down some way or making it really like a seamless user experience. So is the UX going to be worse? Is it going to be harder to find willing customers or users? Like, those are just like very simple questions, like, that I think if you think about it from a user-centric perspective, which is something we've talked a lot about, I think, in like our, just like, just across the board, like, care about the user, think about the user, and like, that generally gives you some good answers on like whether this is going to work or not, right? Just by thinking about the user.
You'd mentioned something in that you're talking about like founders that seem to be afraid to put their name on things. I think like the era of the non-founder is no more. Pretty much like you've seen our pitch decks. Like, we've got like links to our LinkedIn in there. I think that's pretty standard now. But recently I've been hearing this new term pop up on podcasts, and I genuinely am like, I'm like very intrigued because it sounds like very kind of cool. And that term is shadow founder. I have no idea what that means. I assume it's like something. I assume it's exactly like what it sounds like, but I don't know how that even is like, you know, created. What does that term mean to you? And is it like a real thing?
It's not good, Alex. It's not a good term. It means that there's someone behind, it's like a puppet master, right? And like that they've put together this like fake thing that like they're kind of in the background calling the shots, but like no one knows that like they're in charge. So either they have like an outsized influence over the direction of the company. They actually are just like operating the company, and like that's like the like, most extreme case is like that they're operating the company and like running the entire thing, and like their name's not on anything. Their name's not even on the legal documentation, but somehow they have like ownership through this like Panama entity or something. You know what I mean? Something crazy like that. On the other side of it, it's like they have like essentially maybe like a founder's like level ownership in the company, where like, they're just like kind of they put people in place to like build this thing, and like, but they're a founder and like they're in the background, they're in the shadows, right?
But why?
Yeah,
like why do that?
Number one is like, maybe they don't have a very good name, and so they can't be the front person or even be like named on something, because it would immediately like fail to get investment or to see the light of day. The second is, so reputation is one of them, right? I think a second one could be.
Is it like the do not compete? Yeah. So like, make it so like if you're like compete. The founder, I mean, of one that's company. A little bit,
That's a little less like severe, right? Like, but still like pretty bad. It's like, look, I can't be associated with this because like I'm a founder of another company. It's generally not used in a
I mean, it
way
sounds like a
that
villain thing,
is,
right? Like
yes.
I think it's okay to say it's terrible. It's like, a shadow founder. That's like, it's like straight out of like a comic book or something.
Yeah, like
It's
you
like a James
generally
Bond
want.
villain type thing.
You generally want the founders to be known, and you want to be, as an investor, you want to know who the founders are. And I think the general sense there with like a shadow founder is it's not clear whether or not investors even know that this person is a founder. And as long as you're like you're obfuscating some kind of truth, and that is generally a recipe for a bad time.
Yeah, I feel like a non-founder is like the, you don't know who the founder is and that's okay. And then there's shadow founder where it's like you're actively trying to like cover up who's the actual decision maker. So going back to like the L1 versus L2 thing, like we had mentioned that there's, the L1 premium and that's declining. Let me ask you this. When it comes to applications that are like
Well, I don't know if it's
building on an
declining. I don't know
L1
if it's
versus
declining.
L2.
ETH is going up.
Well,
Well, not today, but like ETH was going up and like Solana was going up and like all these like dinosaur chains like XRP, and what and Bitcoin's obviously going up like in like if you zoom out a little bit. And so like it's hard to say that the premium is going away, but I think for newer chains, like we're starting to see like a bit more skepticism in the market that like this commands the same valuation as like some of these chains that literally have nothing on them and are valued at like Cardano, for example. Like there's nothing there. And like it's and so like you can't build like if you built Cardano now, it would not be worth what it's net worth when it launched.
I think Cardano is still trying to build Cardano
Yeah, I feel okay naming that name.
now. Let me ask you this. So like for an app, like let's say you're looking at an app that's building on an L1 and then the same app that's building, like let's say the exact same app, parallel universe, same tech, same founder, same, regulatory environment. And let's say they're building on like an L2. Let's say that the L1 token market cap and the L2 token market cap are exactly the same, although I think that's
Okay.
probably a bad example. Like, would you underwrite those two companies the same way? Or like, how would you approach investing in these two companies where like the only difference is one of the apps is on an L1 and the other one is on an L2?
Great question. So for us, I can tell you what we would do because there's a lot to unpack there. The first thing is like conflict of interest. Which is something I've talked about on like another podcast before. So it's probably highly unlikely that we made both investments at exactly like so because we're such a small team, right? So like you're working with me and Dougie on like all our portfolio companies work with me and Dougie. So like there's no world in which like Dougie is investing in one thing that I don't know anything about, right? And like on the flip side, I am investing in the other thing that Dougie doesn't know anything about. And by some miracle of miracles, like coincidentally, it's the same exact project on two different chains. So, like, we know that we've invested in, so one of these we've invested in before the other, right? And so, when we're having the conversation with the second founder that we couldn't come in contact with, I think the first thing that we're going to do is, like, right from the very beginning of the call, is say, like, hey, by the way, before we even start, like this is interesting, right? But before we even start, we just want to let you know that we made an investment in XYZ. Now, this is also assuming that like either the application is successful, right? And like or still live. Like there's a world where like the application has been live for a really long time. We either have divested from it or it's like not doing well. It's like failed. And just, and which is like very different. But let's assume for the case, for the time being, that it's either successful, we still hold it, or it hasn't even launched yet, right? So, like, information's like kind of proprietary in some way or shape or form. Like, the first thing we're going to do is say, like, hey, look, we made an investment. We're really interested in speaking with you. We made an investment in this other company. They do the same thing as you, like, just like high level based on what we know so far. Like, we think you guys are competing, kind of. Like not within the same ecosystem, but like you are competing of like the mind share level, and like your tech looks pretty similar. And we just wanted to like point that out before we even start this conversation. Like anything that you tell us, like we're not going to share with the other portfolio company. But like just if you, you know, we haven't sent you a term sheet, we're not like we have no allegiance to you. So if there's stuff that you don't want to share, you should feel comfortable in like not sharing that with us. And that's okay. And we understand. And if you just want to end the conversation, we also understand that. And like no harm, no foul. Assuming that we continue with the process, like I think the second thing we're getting interested in like investing in the second company, the next thing we need to do is talk to before we like send them that, a commitment, we need to talk to our existing portfolio company founders and tell them like, hey, we want to invest in this company. They're doing something very similar to you. And here's why it's different. Here's what we haven't shared any of the information that like of what you're working on. We don't intend to, we won't. And you have to like kind of trust us that we're not going to do that, but like we won't do that. And we've never done that. And we will continue to not do that. And there have been a few instances where like there's been enough overlap where like people get a little wary of like, hey, like, we have to ask for permission. You know, we don't ask for forgiveness, we ask for permission. And they, from there, they say yes or no. Like, right. And like, I think most of the time it's like, we don't want to stand in the way of you from like doing something like this. Like, okay, let's assume the answer is yes. Then we make the investment. And like, then we have to like, kind of like try to our best to like, and do exactly what we just said we're going to do, which is like, obviously not share any strategy stuff, obviously not share any tech stuff. And then like really kind of like probably at that point, if we go through with this, Dougie and I are going to wind up like, you're not going to work with both of us most of the time. Like you're going to work with one or the other of us. And like, we'll give updates on like how they're doing. But like, as far as like the details, like we're going to kind of not let you in on every single little secret. Cause we don't want, we need to have like some form of firewall, at a company that's this small.
So, let me ask you like a little bit more of like a slightly different version of that question. Cause I think that's like really interesting. It's like the conflict of interest thing is like a really, like, it seems like a tough thing to navigate, especially cause crypto companies, like if you were to, you know, look at us and then look at like a company that has like in no way competing with us, you know, you could probably describe both of us using like, you know, very similar terms. It's like very hard. I actually spent a lot of time thinking about how to like properly define us so that people don't think we do the same thing as like some other company where like all of us are doing just technical stuff, where if you try to make it not technical with a description, then the descriptions start to overlap. But like, regardless of that, I think like one of the more interesting things I'm like really focused on is like when you guys are looking at valuations and when you guys are like underwriting companies, do you look at a company on an L1 in terms of like a valuation level and like an underwriting like basis? Like, did you like a different type of due diligence on like an L1 company than an L2 company? And like, even more broadly than like L1 versus L2, it's like, you know, how deeply do you look at like what L1 or like what L2 they're on? Like, if you found like the most cracked team, just like nothing but just like ex Citadel people with like, you know, the marketing team behind, I don't even know, like just like amazing marketing, just like amazing quants, and they were like, yeah, man, we're building on Cardano. Like, how would you approach something like that?
I mean, we just wouldn't take the call if they were building on Cardano. So number one is like that probably. Like,
it might be too extreme of an example, but like yeah, for that, like that kind of like question, like directionally that question, because no one's actually building on Cardano, as everybody knows. We're all adults.
Yeah.
Yeah. Santa Claus isn't real, but
I think like, it's a good question. So I think number one is like, why are we talking to someone? Like, I think like most, I am wrong about this. I think for us, we're not going to make an investment in an ecosystem we don't understand. And so I think like, so I don't understand Cardano's ecosystem, right? So in order for me to invest in a company and make a decision, like make like the make the ultimate decision that we're going to invest in this company means that like I have gotten some degree of like conviction in Cardano, the underlying tech, the ecosystem. I know the players. I understand like the who's who, right? And then like not only that, but then I've also gained conviction on the idea and the application and the builders, and that they're going to like also be able to build the thing on this tech stack that I'm relatively unfamiliar with. And so like, that's a lot to ask. And like, I just don't see where that makes any sense for us. Like there's like different examples of this, like where I think when like XRP was like launching, or when Ripple was launching like XRPL or something like that, or like I don't really know what it was like a stable coin or something, like that Robert Leshner like from Robot Ventures like tweeted like, if you're building on Ripple, like reach out. And I was like, interesting, like maybe he's done a lot of research on Ripple. I mean, he's been around for a long time, right? And it's an interesting way to like get people to reach out to you and for you to learn more, right? Because like one of the things about like being in this position is like we can reach out to people, we can talk to them, they're more than interested, more than willing to talk to us, and like we can level up and learn stuff about an ecosystem we know nothing about by talking to a lot of builders that are building in the ecosystem. So like I can educate myself, which is like kind of a waste of the person's time if they're like trying to raise capital and I'm just trying to learn something. But like, you know, I wouldn't say it's like, it's never say never, right? You may have just missed something and you're like, hey, we're really getting bullish on like this ecosystem and we know a lot about it. Presumably like we personally invested something in the ecosystem where we use it or something along that nature. So I think like never say never, because like ultimately we are supposed to find like non-consensus bets and then like make bets on those and like for outsized returns, like that is like part of the job. But like there's a lot of diligence that's going to have to go into that process in order to be able to like
let me ask you this. If you are like really bullish on a team but bearish on the ecosystem that they're building on, like do these two things like have, can they offset each other, or like how do you approach that kind of decision from like underwriting?
I'm laughing because of our relationship. So there's such a thing as like good dev, bad project, right? Like of like a developer that you find that you're like, wow, this guy's knocking it out of the park. Like this guy's great. Why is he working on this thing? And then presumably if that exists, there's also good dev, bad ecosystem, right? And I think for some funds, they just take it. I think you mentioned this, right? They just take it as they see it, right? And they don't like ask any questions and they don't push back or they don't offer anything beyond like, oh, this is what they're building. Yeah, we're not bullish on that. Like there's no chance that this thing is going to make it. And like the founder, but like wrong project. Right. I think there's another world where you kind of just say, well, wait a second. This person is very smart. They're a hustler. They could build in any ecosystem. Like, I wonder if there's like another opportunity that could use their, like, could put their talents to better use. And what does that look like? And what is that? And then, like, kind of like, extrapolate from, and then kind of like do that. That's a lot of work, right? For someone to like kind of go, well, let's figure it out together. It's a big investment, I think, of like time and resources sometimes. Unless it's like, you've done this before, you've done it over here, I think you can do it over there. So I think my answer is like, we've done both, right? We've been like, bummer, like they're really dead set on this one. I can't change their minds. And I think sometimes we've been like, maybe there's a way where we can work together. Maybe there's something, maybe there's a different opportunity or a bigger opportunity. And like, I think it's like hard. It's kind of like, you got to kind of find like there's product market fit, there's product founder fit, and there's like investor founder fit as well, right?
Well, like, let me ask you this. So kind of like reading between the lines of what you were just saying, it is hard to like have some of these conversations without having it like being colored by our own like interactions, but like kind of like reading between the lines, and like for context, like you guys were very opinionated in like a pro Monad way, like for Fastlane. And like, we had already like told all the validators that we were going to support Monad that we were like already working with. And I think you guys just, were like also big fans of Monad. And so like, you know, we were talking about earlier, like, you know, we were very flexible and it was like a great data point. And like, we were able to just like fully commit to like Monad in like an exclusive kind of way.
Yeah, we're excited about that.
But like, let's say you find like an amazing team and they're building, it's just like the best team and it's like a great product and they're building in like an ecosystem that you just, you know, maybe it's like a okay ecosystem, like but not a Cardano, but like, let's say like an L2 that's just kind of like stagnating, as an example.
Poor Cardano.
Well, they deserve it.
That's true.
But like, would it be a pass or like, is there a certain point where like, for instance, like let's say the team, I fucking hate using this example, but like, let's say something like Polymarket, where the actual product in no way like touches the chain that they're building on other than like settlement that's completely abstracted away from the user. Like, is there a world where like, because the app doesn't have to like directly integrate with the ecosystem, that you just like would be comfortable underwriting something in an ecosystem you're bearish on?
So the bigger point here is that like down the road, this shouldn't matter at all, right? Like this, like the ecosystem that you build, like if we actually build all the stuff that we want to build, like user and like if it abstracts away the L1, which ultimately I think maybe leads to like the L1 premium going away, right? Then like it shouldn't matter where you build. You should build on the tech stack that's like most helps optimize what you're building and like provide you with like all of like the benefits of what you're looking for to build your application, right? It's just like, doesn't seem like that's where we are today. I don't think we're there yet. And so like, I feel kind of conflicted saying that, like, I, you know, considering that, because like, yeah, Polymarket has built a great product, like, or they built a great brand and they've gotten product market fit despite being on Polygon right now, right? And like no one really that I know using Polygon other than to use Polymarket. And so I guess I don't feel great about saying that, but that that's like a, it's not that it's a non-starter. It's just like, how are you going to get distribution? Because like if there's no users on the chain, then you have to come up with a different distribution and go-to-market plan. And as long as you can create that and it makes sense, then it shouldn't matter. It actually should not matter, right? But like, what is that plan and how do you plan on breaking through that barrier? Because it's a big barrier.
And you would need to be convinced that they can do it too. So that's like a, it's like a harder pitch to you guys. So it's like possible, but like they would have to be more convincing.
Yeah. And just to be clear, like when Polymarket built on Polygon, like Polygon, I mean, when was it, like 2019? Like, I think probably Polygon was, there were users there and there was like people doing stuff there and it was like faster than Ethereum, right? And like cheaper. And it wasn't like the desert back then, but like it's kind of become the desert and they found ways to like, you know, like abstract away the blockchaininess from the experience.
Let's kind of bring it all home with something that is both a question and also one of my favorite observations about you guys that I didn't really know until recently. I can't remember who I was talking to, but the conversation was around how, like, dude, you know me, I like to shit on crypto VCs all the time. I think one of the reasons why we get along so well is because you also shit on crypto VCs a lot.
No comment.
But I think that like one of the things I think is like really interesting is that like a lot of crypto VCs are just, they're not hands-on. They just kind of, they're lemmings. They follow the leader. you know, you guys are a leader. A lot of the best crypto VCs are a leader. If I look at like the three teams that have like, you know, led rounds for us, it's, you know, you guys, Multicoin and DBA, like all three of you are considered like unaligned, you know, in one way or another. All three of you guys are considered like, you know, non-consensus takes. And all three of you guys, I think, are like doing really well. And I think it like really pays to be an independent thinker, and I value that a lot. And so I can't remember what the exact context was, but I was talking with someone about how like most crypto VCs are just like looking at the token, and they would never invest in something outlandish or new or novel. They, you know, like to stick to the formula. And I was debating on Twitter, and as I'm prone to do, and the dude was like, well, like, what's like an example though of like something that like VCs would invest in that's, you know, like outlandish? And the most ridiculous thing that I had seen recently that came to my mind was sperm racing, the sperm racing contest in Los Angeles. And so I'm like, dude, sperm racing would be something ridiculous that no crypto VC would ever touch. And then I Google it and I look at their round announcement, and right there in the middle of it is Figment Capital. And I love you guys for it. Like, that's like outlandish. Like, I don't know if sperm racing is building on Cardano, or if there's even like a blockchain affiliated with it. But how the fuck did you guys approach underwriting sperm racing?
It actually wasn't that hard, to be honest with you. I will say that it was like probably I think that. Okay, here's how I'll start, right? Is I think the week of Accelerate, the Solana conference in New York City, we had already made the investment like months ago before that. The race had already happened. And I talked to VCs, some of my friends who are like on the venture side. I met brand new people who I've never met before, who were founders. I talked to people who are portfolio company founders. And by and large, the portfolio company that I spoke the most about for an entire week, like, was sperm racing.
For the people who don't know what it is, can you explain what it is? I mean, you can probably
it's exactly what it sounds like, Alex. But I think, so, you know, we heard about this team, I'll go through it a little bit. So we heard about these guys that were, wanted to race sperm competitively, and like they wanted to build the ability to like race sperm, and they were raising money for it, and we were like, we got to talk. Can we talk to these people? Like, I would just want to talk to them and get to know them a little bit and understand what this is. I just want to just hear the pitch. Like, pretty much, we just wanted to hear the pitch, right? And we're like, this is crazy. Like, let's just hear the pitch and. It'll be a fun 35 minutes, 45 minutes, right? And one of the founders at the time lived in New York. He came to the office to talk with us. 17 years old, so he came from college, came right out of school. And we talked to him for a little bit, and we were like, "This is crazy, but it's interesting." And so, like, the thesis actually is, when you hear it, like, you kind of go, "Okay, I can kind of see this." Like, first and foremost is that, like, sperm motility is down, like, generation over generation. It's like nobody kind of really knows why, but it's a scientific fact. Sperm motility is actually like a biometric. It's a biomarker. So you can tell how healthy someone is or isn't by men, by like their sperm motility, and it's pretty taboo to talk about. And so what they wanted to do was sort of bring, so this is like sort of like in the longevity sort of like space, like, you know, Brian Johnson, who's going to try to live forever. There's a big movement of like longevity movement, and these gentlemen want to bring attention to like personal health and longevity through like competitions and of like racing one's sperm with, I guess, another. It was a pretty outlandish, and he's like, look, we have like a big like idea for this, like, we're gonna make it competitive. We want it to be like kind of like the like a UFC or like, you know, a big event, like a spectator sport. We want to host these events, we want people to like compete, And he's like, you know, we're raising some money for it. We wrote a fairly small check into it, just to be clear here.
It was profitable though, right?
We were the first fund. We were like the only fund in the original pre-seed to invest in it. There's a lot of really well-known names that have invested alongside us as angels. And then there was like another fund, Caritage, who came in with like a bit of a pre-seed extension. So we had a markup, and I think they closed their seed round right now. So like they had their first race. It was entertaining. There's also like a lot of different directions that this can go. But I think number one is like, it's kind of outlandish. It's kind of crazy. People can like bet, like sort of like horse racing is also kind of crazy when you think about it. Dog racing is terrible. Like, hey, if you're like an animal rights person, please don't at me. But like, essentially, it's like this kind of crazy thing where like in the world of that we're moving towards, like with AI and like, you know, you have like I think it's called like the extreme sports or something that like Peter Thiel is doing, where like you're going to be able to like take any type of steroids or any sort of performance enhancing drugs that you want to and like try to beat world records. Like that's like coming like next year or this year or something like that. It's just this like, you know, this is a way that like people are going to compete. People will compete on their health and their biometric markers. And people are already wearing Aura rings. People are already counting their steps, monitoring their steps, monitoring their sleeping. People are and they track that. And they also like connect each other to each other's friends and like have competitions. And so like it's not that outlandish that like at some point people will start to like compete on these like other biometric markers, whatever that may be. It could be sperm racing. You could have white blood cells fighting each other by just putting them in a petri dish together, like mine versus yours, and see who wins.
Do you want to join my sperm racing league, by the way? Like we've got like room for like two more.
No, that's okay. I am more of a spectator than I am a participant. But like, so that was like number one. And like, they're looking at a bunch of different angles to go and monetize on this. But like, there was a race. It was in LA. It was well attended. One of our people like went to it. They thought it was like a very interesting. They went into a crowd. People were really loving it. The race is online. They had like 750 million impressions across TikTok, Instagram, all social media. That's crazy number. That's like a crazy number of people. Like everybody that's not in crypto, that is in crypto, if you ask them, if you mention sperm racing, they've seen it. They know what you're talking about. So they were able to do that part, which is break into just like the zeitgeist. They were on TMZ. They were on like Good Morning America. This article was like, this was everywhere. Right. And so, you know, I don't know, like in the attention economy, this seems to have like caught everyone's attention. Maybe it was a slow news week. Maybe people were tired of like war and whatever else and politics, but like it was something that resonated and got people's attention. It's done a very good job at that. And you know, the two founders, there's three founders. One is like Nick, who was like in our office, who now lives in LA. There's a gentleman named Eric who he's also 17. But he's a second time founder. He already started a company. He exited that company. He has a really incredible background. And this is something that he's like very passionate about and wants to like build. And then like, a third founder who, we've met a few times, Shane, I believe his name is. And, he's like also really smart and incredible. And so like, it was like, to me, when you get to meet these people, these founders, and you spend time with them, like there is nobody, I don't think there's anybody who has met them and not said like, how do I invest? And I think that that's like a really impressive thing for such a young group of adults that like are going to build something, and you can kind of just tell if they're going to be successful. They're going to find success. And so I'm more than happy to invest in sperm racing or whatever else they want to build. Like I'm all for it.
That is,
it's just a founder bet.
It just seems like the wildest, like how, if I'm starting a company and I need to get like a co-founder, like that's gotta be like the wildest, like, hey bro, I've got an idea.
It's pretty crazy. And it was like a lot, it was hard to get through IC. but, actually like funny story was like, we went to the IC, and, it needs like everybody to vote yes, right? And there was one no vote initially, and then it was like, well, we should all just angel into it. It was like what the person said, and we essentially were like, wait, so who wants to angel invest into this? And like everybody raised their hand, and we said like, well, that doesn't make any sense. Like if we all want to invest in this thing, then like that, like, A, we can't take that. We don't normally angel invest. Like most of us don't angel invest anything. It's very rare. But like occasionally occurs. But like if we're all a yes to angel invest, then like clearly there's something here that we want to invest in. Like we have to do it out of the fund. We have a fiduciary duty. And so it was this like moment where it was like this aha moment where it was like, oh, so everybody actually thinks this is pretty good investment. It's going to do pretty well. Like, okay, we should invest. And so we did.
That's awesome. That's like such like a good story. I'm super. I'm obviously very bullish FIG Cap, but I'm like that to me is like, you guys were the only crypto fund I saw on their list, and I was like, yeah, that checks out. These guys are
Not
independent.
anymore,
Well, yeah, but like you
but
guys
we
are
are.
the trendsetter. Like you guys got in when it was like you guys got in before it was big. So I have like a lot of respect for that.
Fun times.
Well, dude. Thank you so much for joining us. Even if you're not going to join my sperm racing fantasy league, with me and the boys,
Never say never.
never say no. But dude, thank you for joining me on the podcast. Dude, I feel like there's a lot of stuff I wanted to ask you about that we didn't get to today, just because there's just so
I'm
much
around.
in the space. Yeah, like looking forward to doing another episode with you. Dude,
Sam,
thanks for coming on
thanks
board,
for having
man.
me. Dude, thanks for having me. It's great to do this. Hopefully we set the world on fire with the podcast. You're doing a great job. Like every episode's been great so far. I've been watching them, and you're obviously doing a great job at Fastlane, and like Fastlane's a bit amazing. And just thanks for taking the time to, and thanks for asking me. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Talk soon.
All right, sir. Tip.